We are on the last sermon of the series that we've been doing on the Ten Commandments. And we hit a very interesting one. If you want to kind of stick your finger in your Bible to hold the actual passage, 1 Timothy 6, then you can go back to Exodus chapter 20. And essentially we see this, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning in our introduction to the series, I mean, the Ten Commandments are an amazing document, if you want to think about it that way. They're concise, they're clear, and they address both kind of the major spiritual issues and the major moral issues that not just the Israelites, but all of humanity would forever face. The 10th commandment that we have here in Exodus 20 says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's." And I mean, that's kind of as moral as it gets. You know, it talks about, you know, this wanting, this desiring. And in a very interesting way, it points us back to the first commandment in its fulfillment. But as you know, as we tackle kind of this last commandment and this last sermon on the Ten Commandments, you know, I wanted to remind you that, you know, as we've been going through this, we've been trying to kind of take a positive view or a holistic view towards the commandments. Now, it's easy to take a negative view. It's easy to, you know, they're negative statements. It says, "You shall not." And we think about, you know, the ways in which they are restrictive, and they are restrictive. But we forget that what God intends through these things is to provide life. In a lot of ways, the Ten Commandments are a blueprint of how life works or how it's supposed to work. And that when we end up breaking the commandments, we end up actually breaking ourselves. You know, we miss out on the fullness and the fulfillment that God has for us. And so in number 10, we're looking at this issue of covetousness. And that's not a word we often use. You know, we don't go around talking about coveting things. Oh, we don't walk into the mall and go, "I really covet those jeans." You know, we don't use that language anymore. But essentially this idea of covet, I mean, we do use the language of want, of need, of desire. And in that sense, I mean, what we see in commandment number 10 is that we shouldn't desire other people's stuff, right? We shouldn't desire other people's status. Essentially, that's kind of the way it breaks down when it talks about it. Home and wife. I mean, at that point, wife was still seen as possession of the husband, but it was that you don't covet someone else's things, the things that they properly have. And when it comes to servants and those things, it's that you don't covet their status either. And again, you know, what we see is this blueprint. And what commandment number 10 ultimately is about is it is about coveting. It is about, you know, don't want the things that belong to your neighbor, that they have, that they are. It's a commandment about contentment. You know, it's a commandment about finding a sense of peace and contentment in the things that you have and the things that you are. And, you know, if you want to give a very simple definition of what contentment is it's the sense of satisfaction, this sense of pleasure, this peace. Paul in the Greek uses a word that essentially means what we think it means. It means satisfaction, but it also goes a little bit further and means sufficiency. And essentially the word sufficiency means it's sufficiency is this idea of more of a longer term thing. You know, when we think about contentment, it can be very momentary. It can be very fleeting. What Paul is talking about, though, is this state in which it's longer term. It's not momentary. It's not fleeting. And when he uses this term, because it's connected to this idea of sufficiency, it's this idea that we feel whole or complete, that we have enough, that there's a sense in which we have the things that are necessary. And that's really this idea of contentment. And so again, you know, the case study that we're going to use today is in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 through 10. And essentially, as we look at it through the lens of contentment, it answers three questions about it. First, it answers why we need it. Second, what endangers it? And third, when it comes to contentment, how we get it. Okay, so as we look at this passage and look at it through the lens of contentment, we'll find out why we need it, what endangers it, and how we get it. First, contentment, why we need it. Okay, so 1 Timothy chapter 6, if you go to verses 3 through 7, we find this first piece of the puzzle. And this is what Paul says to his mentor, sorry, to his mentee. Paul's the mentor. He says to his protege, verse 3, he says, if anyone teaches a doctrine, different doctrine, and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that accords with godliness, he is puffed up and conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words which produce envy, dissent, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and depraved of truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we have brought nothing into the world, and we can take we cannot take anything out of the world. So essentially, that's kind of where we start. This is our kind of case study. And essentially, in verses, if you look at the entire book of 1 Timothy, it's a letter that Paul is writing, again, to his protege, Timothy, who has become a minister. He's a young man, so he needs a lot of help from Timothy, from Paul. He's served with Paul in different places, and now he's been given responsibility over a particular church plant, particular group of people. And so Paul is writing to him to remind him about the things that are important, things that are necessary. And one of the things he stresses at the very end is the need for sound doctrine. And obviously, you know, as someone who he's writing to, who's a minister, who's taking care of a church, body of believers, as a servant, it makes sense. He's telling him that, you know, he should keep his doctrine straight. And he says, if you don't, you know, then there's going to be quarrels. There's going to be controversies. And that's true. What's interesting, though, is in verse 6, he says, he adds to this. He says, but godliness with contentment is great gain. And, you know, it's very powerful, because when I was thinking about it, I was thinking, like, contentment in my mind isn't really high on my list of spiritual priorities. Right? It's not one of those things that we think about very often. We say, oh, yeah, I need contentment. You know, we put a lot of other things into that latter list of what spiritual growth and spiritual maturity look like. But Paul, especially to Timothy here, he says, not only is godliness, sound doctrine important, but sound doctrine, you know, that form of godliness, sound doctrine along with contentment, that's great gain for you. That's curious, right, that he puts us so high on the list. And as I mentioned, you know, as we talk about what contentment is, it's more than just this sense of satisfaction. It's a sense of sufficiency, that I have all that I need, that all that I need is there for me. A better way to put it, I can't remember where I heard this, but a better way to put it is contentment is a sense of equilibrium, right? It's a sense of equilibrium that helps you face both good and bad situations, right? To face both good times and bad times. And that's a really interesting way to put it, because that's kind of what contentment is, right? If you find a sense of peace, it's this equilibrium that when you are struggling, when you have a lack, or when you have too much, it's this thing that keeps you balanced. It's this thing that helps you that when you don't seem to have enough or as much as everyone else seems to have, it keeps you steady. And then when you have more than you need, it keeps you steady. And I think especially in an area like this, it's especially valuable to us. And what Paul is talking about is he's not saying that this is something that is momentary, that is quick, that is, you know, he's saying that it's something that you can have that lasts, that is a state, that is something that you experience for a long time. And, you know, when you hear that, when I hear that, in a lot of ways, it seems foreign, because in a lot of ways, I mean, in our world, everything in our culture is about wanting, about getting, about needing, about having. That's the role of advertisement, isn't it? Right? Like anything that they want to sell you, they try to convince you that you need it. Even if it's the most obscure, unimportant, unnecessary thing, they try to tell you that you need it. And they try to connect it to this idea of contentment, of happiness, of joy, of pleasure, that if you have it, then everything else will be better. So we live in that kind of culture, and we live that up, right? We make lists of things that we want. Now, just to kind of make sure you hear this, there's not a problem with wanting. You know, there's not a problem with wanting. There is a problem with taking a want and making it a need. And there's a big difference between those two, right? I mean, we can want something, but the minute a want turns into a need, it controls us. It takes a hold of us. It burrows its way into our brain, and it affects the way that we treat people. And there's a difference between that. But I mean, the truth is that we live in a world of wanting. We make lists for everything, right? I mean, we make lists of what types of things we want to do, what type of experiences we want to have, places we want to eat at. We make bucket lists for things we want to do over the course of the rest of our lives until we die. We scout out areas for vacations, and we plan out the things we want to do. And, you know, even if we have no plans to go there, we already know them. At Christmas, we make tons of lists. We tell our kids to make lists. My wife, Grace, and I were just talking about how one of the things we never did, well, when the kids were little, in some ways, we were good parents, in some ways we were bad parents. But when they were little, we didn't really do Christmas gifts for our kids. We used to tell them that we go out together and buy a gift, and they could give it to someone. And in some ways that was good, some ways that was bad in certain ways. But we were just talking about how, like, when they were little, we would go into stores, we would go shopping, and a lot of times the cashiers or the people that we were dealing with, they would turn to the kids and say, "What's on your Christmas list?" And our kids were always like, What's a Christmas list? And it always kind of like, you know, the cashiers or the people were dealing, they never knew like how to deal with that. They were always like, "Well, you don't have a Christmas list? You don't have things that you want?" But I mean, we make lists for everything. And again, there's nothing wrong with wanting. I think we have a culture that's built on wanting. The problem is our culture tries to move as much as it can from the want to the need category. And that's where the problem arises. Again, you know, you look at commercials, advertising. Advertisers tell us that we need not just a car, we need a new car. You know, it tells us we need a new phone, new computer, new fabric softener, and that all these things will drastically change our lives. And when you believe it, we run out and we buy those things, and then we realize it doesn't really do that. Right? It doesn't really have that effect. But I mean, that's the culture. The culture is that we should want, and that what we want, we should get. That's actually, in a lot of ways, that's been the most interesting change over my lifetime with Christmas. Is I remember when I was younger, Christmas was about getting people presents. It's about getting people gifts. I feel like the last 10, 15 years, Christmas has become the time where now you get to buy the thing that you've always wanted. And it's not about, right, you getting something for someone else. It's the time I can splurge on myself. That's a huge difference. And what verse 8 says, what Paul tells Timothy, and in effect tells us, verse 8, he says, "But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content." Right? I mean, he shrinks it down as small as he can. He says, these are the things you really need. The other stuff you don't. And I think that's a powerful reminder, because in our culture, that's not the message. Food and clothes. The message is you need it all, or at least as much as the people you know, at least that much. And it's a very, very difficult message to get around. It's something that we are constantly bombarded by. And essentially, that's what this commandment is about. You know, it hits us square in the eyes because it attacks this part of the culture, the sense in which we turn our wants into needs. And culturally, you know, it doesn't work well when things are built on want, because then greed comes into the picture. You know, the most interesting thing to me is for Paul and for Timothy, they live in a very different culture, right? There's no iPhones, there's no tech gadgets, but it's the exact same problem. It's desire, it's greed, it's envy, it's craving, it's comparison, right? All those same things. So that's the first thing we see. We see this first kind of issue of why we need to hear, why we need to deal with commandment number 10, this issue of coveting and ultimately contentment, why we need it. Second thing we see is we see what endangers it. In other words, what challenges it, what throws it into flux, what pulls us out of this desire for contentment. If you look at verses 9 and 10, it says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains." I think one of the most powerful things the verse 9 does is it takes this idea of coveting and it uses a term, it says, it calls it desires. And you know, what you need to know is in the Bible, desires aren't neutral things, right? Desires aren't just kind of your run-of-the-mill wants of, yeah, it'd be nice to have that. Oh, that looks good. Now, what is that? It's not your run-of-the-mill kind of, you know, you see something and you say, oh, that would be nice to have for myself. In the Bible, the word, this idea of desires is never used in a neutral, just purely descriptive way. It's always meant to describe sinful desires, over desires, right? Again, where we take things that are wants and make them needs, right? It's a word that's used to describe sinful, selfish desires. And, you know, like I said, you know, wants can be innocent. They can be kind of wishes, but desires are problematic, right? Desires are different. Now, when I was in seminary, I think it was my third year. I was in seminary for 4 years. My third year, my car broke down. And I remember calling my mom and told her that the car had broken down. And it was an old car. It was kind of on its way out. And so she knew and I knew that at some point we're going to have to deal with it. And so, you know, I think in talking to her, she said, oh, you know, I've this much that you can use on the car, and then you can add to it whatever you have saved up or whatever you want to finance, as long as you know you're going to pay for it. And I said, okay, that's good. And so, you know, I was talking to one of my friends about it, and, you know, I was trying to decide what kind of car to get, you know, something that's practical, something that could, you know, that would be useful in terms of getting to church, which was for me down in a different state. So I'd have to drive about an hour and a half every single day, every single week to go back and forth. So I wanted something reliable. I wanted something that would, you know, not take up too much gas. So I went to go look for a Civic, and I've had a bunch of Civics over the years. I ended up leaving with an Acura, and a really nice one at the time. It was actually, you know, this is when Acura first came out, and I got one of their, you know, it was basically kind of the same model as the Civic, but really, really nice. It was fast. It was, you know, beautiful color. It had a sunroof. And I could give you all these different reasons why. The real reason why I walked in, I saw it, and I said, I have to have that. And essentially, as the salesman talked me into it, I said, that's a good argument. That's a good reason. Okay. I took the car home. My friend knew I was out shopping for cars, and he knew I was intending to buy one that day. So he comes over in the afternoon. He knocks on the door. He opens it. He turns, you know, he's already seen the car on the way in. He turns, he looks at the car, looks at me, and God, you know, his first words to me were, "You're sinning." And I still remember that. I didn't know how to respond to that. I said, no, this is not what you think. And so he came in, and essentially we had a discussion for about an hour where he made his case that, you know, that the only reason why I got it was for all these other reasons, not the stuff that I said, and back and forth. Long story short, took the car back, returned it, went out and got the car I was originally intending. But all of that was just desire. Nothing else. You know, as much as you know, in the moment I wanted to paint it as other things. Oh, this car is probably a little bit more reliable, or, you know, whatever else I could think of. It's just desire. Getting caught up in the moment. It's wanting something to such a degree that didn't matter, like what it would cost or what it meant. And, you know, that, you know, I would love to say that's the only time that's ever happened. It's not. It's happened with other things all throughout my life. From that point on, it's happened with small things, with bigger things at different times. But it's a reminder that, to me at least, the desires are powerful. Right? They can warp our sense of reality. Right? We see something and immediately the want turns into a need and everything looks different. The old things look like trash. And all of a sudden, something is attached to that desire. We say, boy, if I only had that. And there's different things we attach to the end of that, but we say, if I only had that, then, and we attach something to that. And then we argue the case, well, without it, I mean, what would my life be, right? But, you know, it's this very powerful, very intoxicating thing where the moment a want turns into a need, the argument is to have it would make things immeasurably better, to not have it would make things immeasurably worse. And that's not true. It's never true. I mean, there's no material possession that can do that. There are things that are necessary. There are things that are good. There's nothing there's no product that will make your life immeasurably better or immeasurably worse. And yet what desire does is it attaches those labels to those things and we believe it. It warps our reality. We accept it at face value and we dive in. And ultimately what we're doing, the reason why desire is so powerful is because not only are we buying something, but in the process of buying it, in the process of chasing after it, in the process of obtaining it, we are placing our hope, our trust, we are placing everything on the line to get it. We're willing to break things to obtain it. And we have this expectation that once we have it, nothing will be the same. And you know, in a very powerful way, I mean, nothing does that. Nothing that we can buy changes those things. It doesn't fix us. They don't. They can't. You know, and then when you look into verses 9 and 10 again, you know, what he says is verse 9, he says, they plunge us into ruin and destruction. Right? And that's a very powerful phrase. The end of verse 9, he says, they plunge us into ruin and destruction. And, you know, unchecked, that's what they do, right? I mean, if you take a look into prison, you find the guy who's in jail for embezzling money, and it started with these desires. Oh, if I could only get a little bit more, right? And then there's the opportunity. You know, it's not just kind of that desires destroy our physical lives like that it leads us to stealing, embezzling, cheating, breaking trust with people. It also kind of spiritually destroys us. You know, it also brings us to spiritual harm, to spiritual destruction. And this whole idea of believing the lie that this thing will change my life, well, all of us know this, but what happens when you get it? It doesn't work. Or if you don't get it, depression. And either way, what it does is it creates this hopeless expectation that ends up ruining our souls. It creates this expectation where thing after thing that you say, no, you can save me, you can fix me, you can make things right, you can make my life better, thing after thing that you say that of, thing after thing that you either get or don't get, you realize it doesn't work. What it does is it drives you down into despair. Because you're looking in the wrong place. Now, ultimately, what you're looking for is the thing underneath all those things, and that's Christ. He is the only one that transforms. He is the only one that changes. And yet when you place your hope in these possessions and these things and these purchases and these experiences, when they don't pan out or when you never get them to start with, it devastates your soul. And what it ends up doing is it's breaking you. We actually have a term for that. It makes you a cynic, right? You become cynical. A cynic is someone who's been broken by his expectations, who's seen that life does not live up to what it promises. And that's exactly what happens to us. We become cynical. We become spiritual cynics. And we point that cynicism, not just at the world, but we point it at God too. And it ruins us spiritually. It wrecks us. And you know, the sad thing is, like I said, it doesn't just wreck our lives in terms of, you know, jail or possible death, you know, those types of things. It destroys us spiritually. It destroys all of our relationships too. And eventually, you know, what it says in verse 9 is true, that it plunges people into ruin and destruction. So here's the third thing that we have to answer, which is how can we get out of it? And hopefully there is a way out of it. Verse 6 through 8, Paul says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we have brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of the world." Paul earlier in Philippians chapter 4, he talks about how he has learned to be content with both plenty and in want. And in chapter 4, he talks about the secret of contentment. I think when you put his letters together and you put some of these ideas together, we actually see that in Paul's mind, there's actually two parts to the answer of how we get contentment, how we find contentment. First one is here. So if you look into this passage, he talks about, it says, we brought nothing into the world, we can take nothing out of the world. And so the first part of the answer is this. Part of the way we find contentment is we find contentment when we take on a biblical view of life. Right? He talks about bringing nothing into the world, being able to take nothing out of the world. And essentially, it's this understanding, this Christian understanding, that this life is a temporary state and that what awaits us afterward is eternity. And obviously, all of that changes depending on whether you know Christ or not, but all of us are eternal beings. We will live forever somewhere. If you're a Christian, then eternity means being in God's presence. And so, you know, what he's talking about is this idea that as Christians, we understand that life is just kind of these 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years here, but that there's so much more that awaits us, right? There's this eternity that stretches out for us from the moment we die. And in that perspective, I mean, even a long life, 90 years, 100 years, is nothing compared to eternity. Right? So if we have this biblical mindset, then we understand that when it comes to hardships or difficulties or not having enough at times or, you know, worrying about that, we realize that in the end scheme of things, I mean, why do we need to worry about that? Why do we need to be broken down over what we have or don't have? Because one day we will have it all. And, you know, historically, that's what this idea of contentment is, this idea that Christians, eternity and the shortness of life, Christians have used these things to withstand incredible hardship, incredible suffering, incredible persecution, even death, because of this biblical view of eternity. That because they had this view that this life is short and there's nothing they've brought in, nothing they can take out of the world, Christians have been able to face terrible situations with equilibrium and with confidence and with contentment. And you see how different that is than a secular view of life, right? In a secular view of life, all there is this life. There is no meaning in this life, but all there is this life. You make of it what you will, and there's nothing else. On that view, I mean, where do you find contentment? Right? If you're in need, where do you find help? Where do you find hope? But that's the first place. The first place that Paul says that we find it is in having a biblical view of life, that we understand that this life is short and there's an eternity that awaits us. The second part of it is found in Hebrews. If you go to Hebrews chapter 13, in verse 5, we find the second part of the answer of how we get contentment. In verse 5, the writer says this. He says, keep your life free from the love of money. You notice that that's what Paul was talking about before, about the love of money being the root of all kinds of evil. He says, keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. And I want you to hear his reason why. He says, be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Interesting. The writer of Hebrews says this. He says, the reason why you can be content is because as a Christian, the one thing you have, the one thing that no one can take away is God. Right? He says, verse 5, he says, keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have, for God has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And in 1 Timothy, he's talking about physical, material needs. In Hebrews, he's talking about spiritual, emotional needs. And when you put that together, what you begin to see is this is where contentment comes from. It comes from viewing my life and my situation through the lens of the Bible, what's real and what's true, what awaits me. But it's also rooted in understanding that there is something that I have that is the only true single thing that I ever need, and that is Christ. And if I have him, nothing can take that away. You know, that's what Christians for centuries held on to as they faced suffering, as they faced torture, as they faced persecution, as they faced death. They were able to sing while being burned on the cross. They were able to celebrate while they were being eaten alive. They were able to charge into difficult situations of persecution, knowing they were going to catch diseases and suffer for the sake of the name, because they knew that the one thing that they needed was the one thing that was promised to them that would never leave or forsake them, that they had Christ. And, you know, that's what we celebrate today. You know, communion is a reminder that what Jesus has done is he has given himself to us in such a way that we can never lose him. You know, on the cross, Jesus laid down his life. And in laying down his life, he offers it to us.